So continuing in the book of Philippians, I'm going to read the passage that we're covering today. And it is from Philippians chapter 2 and verse 19 to verse 30. Philippians chapter 2, verse 19 to verse 30. Paul writes, "I hope in the Lord Jesus to send Timothy to you soon, so that I too may be cheered by news of you." If you remember, Paul has received Epaphroditus from the Philippian church. They sent him with a gift and with news. And Paul has had Epaphroditus visiting him while Paul is in prison. And Paul now is sending Timothy to see the Philippians. So he says, "I hope in the Lord Jesus to send Timothy to you soon." So that's going to happen. "So that I too may be cheered by news of you. For I have no one like him who will be genuinely concerned for your welfare. For they all seek their own interests, not those of Jesus Christ." Kind of generalizes. We don't really know exactly who the they is, but he could well be, and most commentators say he's referring to other believers who aren't like Timothy. Other believers who are generally just pursuing their own interests and not putting the interests of Christ first. And it's an interesting juxtaposition if you look at what Paul's writing, because earlier in chapter 1 and verse 21, Paul said, "For me, to live is Christ and to die is gain." And so from Paul's perspective, to live is Christ, and now you could contrast that with this, "For they all seek their own interests, not those of Jesus Christ." And in a sense, there's two ways that people live out their lives. They're either going to live out their lives saying, "My life is devoted to Christ and whatever he calls me to do, wherever he sends me, I will go. Whatever he tells me to do, I will do. I live for Christ. That is why I'm on earth." Or else otherwise, you're generally just living for yourself to try and build up a comfortable life. And Paul views Timothy as a rare gift. He says, "I have no one like him who will be genuinely concerned for your welfare. For they all seek their own interests, not those of Jesus Christ. But you know Timothy's proven worth, how as a son with the father he has served with me in the gospel. I hope therefore to send him just as soon as I see how it will go with me. And I trust in the Lord that shortly I myself will come also. I have thought it necessary to send you Epaphroditus, my brother and fellow worker and fellow soldier, and your messenger and minister to my need." So now he's saying, "I'm also sending Epaphroditus." In fact, Epaphroditus is the one who delivered this letter. "For he has been longing for you all and has been distressed because you heard that he was ill. Indeed, he was ill, near to death, but God had mercy on him, and not only on him, but also on me, lest I should have sorrow upon sorrow. I'm the more eager to send him, therefore, that you may rejoice at seeing him again, and that I may be less anxious." So it's like Epaphroditus was sent by the Philippians to Paul, and the context where Paul was, somehow Epaphroditus got sick and he nearly died. And Paul is now sending him back healthy and saying, "Well, you guys can have him back now. He's been a blessing to me, and I will be less anxious that he's back with you where you are missing him and he's been missing you, and now he's strong enough so he can return and I'll be less anxious." It's kind of humorous because he's almost saying, "I don't want to get blamed, you know, that your messenger, your favorite guy, Epaphroditus, was sent to me and then he died because I didn't look after him." So Paul's almost saying, "I'll be less anxious because I've been feeling responsible for him. I was feeling that burden that he's not mine, he's yours, but he's a blessing to me, but I'm sending him back to you so I can breathe a sigh of relief." Oh, it's just like when you receive short-term missionaries in Madagascar and one of them gets really sick and then he recovers and gets on the plane to head back to wherever he came from, and you're like, "Whew, that guy's out of here. At last." I mean, he was a blessing to have, but it was also quite a stress when he took ill. You get it? It's real. This is what relationships are like. And so, I don't know how many times you as a missionary have seen a visitor off at the airport and they're going back to wherever they came from, and you're like, "Phew, Now he's safely out of Madagascar, where he could have been killed by some rare tropical disease. There are people who have nearly died for the work of Christ here, and there are people who have. So this is real living. This is what the early church is like. This is what the church is supposed to be like. So Paul says, I'm the more eager to send him, therefore, that you may rejoice at seeing him again, and that I may be less anxious. So receive him in the Lord with all joy, and honor such men. For he nearly died for the work of Christ, risking his life to complete what was lacking in your service to me. It's a weird phrasing, but it isn't as harsh as it sounds there in the English. There was nothing lacking in the Philippians' service. Epaphroditus was just the one that brought it to completion by delivering the gift, that the care package that was being sent for Paul, some news, some offerings, some support. So what we see here is, to me, a progression that Paul has made in trying to bring a normal feel back into what he's been writing. He's been speaking about Jesus for a while, about Jesus humbling himself, about Jesus being an example to us in humility, even to the point of death on the cross. And then Paul's written a bit about himself and saying, to him, you know, to live is Christ and to die is gain. And, you know, and then he's exhorting the Philippians to imitate Christ and to live their lives for the gospel and to live their lives for Christ. And then it's almost like he anticipates. People are going to say, yeah, it's all well and good for you. You're an apostle with some super grace operating in your life. We're just normal folk. And then Paul adds in, actually, let me talk about another guy, Timothy, and another guy, Epaphroditus, and show you that the normal folk can also have extraordinary commitment. And I think that's the key for us to understand, that we're included. We're not different from Paul, or he doesn't have some kind of a super special grace that enabled him to be committed to God. You and I can be committed to God because Paul was, and Timothy was, and Epaphroditus was. And even though not everyone is like that, as Paul said, Timothy is really somebody not like all the others who aren't devoted to Christ. Why not you be that person? Yeah. Why not you decide that you want to live your life for Jesus? Yeah. You can. And the interesting thing about this for me is the soil in which all of this develops is so deeply relational. It's so personal and warm. The way he's writing about you missing Epaphroditus, he's been longing to see you. I'm sending him back to you now. The way Jesus built with his disciples was absolutely radical. There was something completely uncharacteristic of any other leadership that I've ever seen in terms of trying to establish what has become the world's biggest organization, the church. Jesus said, I've built my church, and then he went about hanging out with his disciples, sending them on mission, having meals with them, and when the end of that journey was at hand and Jesus was about to be betrayed, in order for Jesus to be identified, the officials, the soldiers that wanted to arrest Jesus, they couldn't tell which guy to arrest. Jesus had to be betrayed by Judas going up and identifying him amongst the other disciples with a brotherly kiss. I guess it was a Mediterranean kind of greeting, a kiss here on the cheek, and that's the guy we have to arrest. How would you build the biggest organization? Would you be almost like one of the team, just friends, not wearing a fancy robe, no big hat on your head to say you're the bishop? It's incredible. And in John 15, verse 15, Jesus says, no longer do I call you servants, for For the servant does not know what his master is doing. But I've called you friends, for all that I've heard from my Father, I've made known to you. So Jesus says, I'm including you as a kind of an equal, a younger brother amongst in the family. You, everything that how my Father's business runs, I'm going to tell you, because you're going to also be part of running my Father's business. You're going to build the church with me, and you're not just a servant. You're a friend, because you understand something, because I'm not going to keep you in the dark, but include you as a full heir with an inheritance. So what we're part of as the church is not organizational, even though it's like the most massive empire on earth. And what we're trying to build in TCC as a local church isn't just committees and administration. It is the kind of relationships that Jesus demonstrated with his own disciples. And Paul has carried the same heart into how he builds. And the work is almost entirely dependent on good relationships. He urges individuals to agree with each other in the Lord, like randos, random people. Philippians 4 verse 2, I entreat Euodia and I entreat Syntyche to agree in the Lord. I've referred to that text already last week or week before. It's just two saints in the church, but Paul names them by name because he cares for the relational integrity within the body of Christ. So it's not good enough that we just come and sit and face forwards on a Sunday.
Yeah.
And this is where I'm heading. I want to talk a bit about our church and how we should be relational. And this is a heart unity. He says they should agree in the Lord. There must be more than we agree in doctrine or we agree in our constitution. The reason I didn't hand you the handbook of the church that tells you what our creed is so that you can decide if you're in or out is because there isn't a handbook. It is a question of, do our hearts knit? Are our hearts for one another? Or are we just a lot of guys doing our own thing for Jesus? We don't really care about each other much. So there's this heart unity. It's agreeing in the Lord. So we see Paul has a standard of relational excellence. Everything in this letter is warm encouragement. There's not admonitions. He's not rebuking. And he repeatedly speaks of joy. And he's emphasized the need for humility, and he's referred to himself. But now he's quickly moving on to say, actually, this is for everyone. There's Timothy and Epaphroditus, and there should be unity and friendship and joy. I think this is a kind of a lovely proof case of how the gospel spreads from person to person. Because if you even look at it more closely, you'll see that Paul, when Jesus first came, he said, I've come to the Jews. And he knew that the gospel would go to the Gentiles. Of course, the gospel was always for everyone. But he said first to the Jews. But then we see Paul gets saved on the road to Damascus, and he's a Jew. He's a Pharisee. I mean, you don't get more Jewish, committed, religious than that. He's got pedigree, if you like, in Judaism. And then Timothy, the next character here, he's born to Jew and Greek parents. So he's now half Jewish, half Greek. And then you get to Epaphroditus, who in his name is actually Aphrodite, the god, the pagan god. Imagine you're named after a pagan god, and you're born from Gentile parents. And this is now how Paul describes the situation, that he's my brother, fellow worker, fellow soldier, my son. And so there's all this family and togetherness that's been developed out of what is culturally completely irreconcilable. It's impossible for you and me to be friends culturally, but it's possible for you and me to be brothers in the gospel. It's impossible for us to get on with each other in normal life, we would never have met some of each other in this room. One set of this congregation would have been flying at 30,000 feet economically and the other at 5,000 feet economically. You just wouldn't be in the same room. But it's not good enough that we're just in the same room. And this is the revelation I want us to have, is that a church doesn't get here by accident, but by intentionally prioritizing quality relationships, like Paul does in this letter. So what does it mean to us to value friendship and to build relationally? Well, I shared this a couple of years ago, that friendship is supposed to be present in the best contexts. For example, in Song of Solomon 5 verse 16, we read, "His mouth is most sweet and he is altogether desirable. This is my beloved and this is my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem." It's not just romance in a good marriage, it's friendship. This person is my friend, my beloved is also my friend. And Jesus, who is our beloved, is also our friend. Friendship adds this richness and meaning to life itself. In fact, I can't quote you C.S. Lewis' quote on friendship, but he spectacularly said that friendship had no point in itself, but it gave meaning to life. In other words, friendship isn't needed for survival, but survival without friendship is pointless. Life without that is meaningless. And so friendship actually is almost at the apex of existence in terms of its aesthetic value, its true beauty. And yet most of us don't appreciate that kind of thing instinctively. We're more functional than relational because we're actually relationally dysfunctional. We come into this world as men to build things and fix problems, and we don't really understand how to just enjoy each other. See, if marriage was just for procreation, that means just for making babies, then friendship would be irrelevant. And if church is just for worship, then fellowship is unnecessary. So be careful that you're not the type of Christian that thought church was just for worship, because then you probably would think marriage is just for procreation. There's so much more in God's plan. That's why Jesus said, "I don't call you servants, I call you friends." See, it's easy to become functional, both in how marriages, in how we view our marriages, or how we operate, or in how we view the church. We can easily form an association to get a task done. Some couples, their marriages become very functional. It's just like, you do this, I do that, this is your responsibility, this is my responsibility. It's a tragedy. If all we have to do as a church is gather to organize, so that we know, you do the sound, you do the tea, you do the, you know, follow up, you do this ministry, you do that ministry, we can be very organized and very functional. It's tragic. See, if we can easily form an association to get a task done, it is possible you can form an association to get a task done. That's sometimes what we would call a business. You've formed some formal structure in order to achieve a purpose. The question is, what, when the job is done, what is left? What remains when the job is done? My question then to us as Christians would be, what remains when Jesus comes back? See, what remains when Jesus comes back? Because then the job is done. There's no more preaching the gospel. There's no more evangelism. There's no more caring for the poor. There's no more social upliftment programs. There's no more of any of that functionality. So what are you looking forward to? Hanging out with me for a long time. Will that be sweet? I mean, Joseph, I look forward to sitting down with you for hours and hours and hours in heaven. because I'm learning to enjoy you on earth. See, what will bring sweetness to our togetherness if our togetherness is only built around a task, a function, a mission we're trying to accomplish? And in fact, sometimes those very missions can become divisive and be like, I'm doing this, and I'm doing that, and we're competing with each other in some way. It's rubbish. Mm-hmm. It's tragic. Organizations looking at each other, operating in the same space. I spoke about this a couple of weeks ago. How you become suspicious of one another within the body of Christ because you're threatened by each other. What a tragedy. Mm-hmm. I should be trying to blow wind in your sails. Try to fan your fire to flame, and you should be doing the same for others. Because ultimately, it's Jesus who unites us. It's not the work that we're doing. And ultimately, you don't have to be friends to get a job done. So what is friendship for? It is the transcendent meaning of us. It is more than the icing on the cake. It's the refreshing spring in the middle of the labor of life. In fact, it's friendship that for our children changes their view of church. When my kids were really little, they pleaded the one day, like, can't we go to church? Can't we go to church? I said, no. Why can't we go? Because it's not Sunday. It wasn't Sunday, but they wanted to go. Why did they want to go? Because when they went to church, they saw their friends. They enjoyed hanging out with people. They said, this is great to be part of a happy throng, a happy company of believers. When you know your friends are going to be at one place, and then you go to another, that would be weird. It's like you hear all your friends are going to KFC, so you go to Aero Pizza. Or you hear all your friends are going to Aero Pizza, so you go to KFC. It doesn't make sense, does it? We wouldn't do that. But we do that in the church. For a lot of the time we go here and then we go there. Most of the time, some of the time here, some of the time there, some of the time somewhere else. Why? Because we haven't made friends. Because we haven't embraced this community and say, this is where I'm going to make my home, my family. And yet many of you have. So I'm not saying all of us haven't done that. I'm just trying to show you how important it is that we value that. You build friendship here, you become part of it here. That's where it takes time though. It takes effort. You have to stick around. Where am I in my notes? So Jesus called his servants friends, and there was a deep revelation in this. After serving, they had become friends. Before the Great Commission, they were already friends. And not wanting freedom from him, they wanted more of him. And we shouldn't be in a rush to leave, to be free from here. We should say, can we stay and enjoy our fellowship? Look at them hanging out at the Last Supper. That picture of Jesus at the Passover and John, who describes himself as the disciple whom Jesus loved. Not the disciple that worked the best or did the most for Jesus, but the disciple that Jesus loved. And he's reclining up against Jesus. He's literally leaning against Jesus. There's intimacy. There's warmth. Now this isn't going to do it, really, not enough. Obviously, we want to have time there at the Boma after the meeting where people can just hang out together. And some of us, I think, we don't, it's not easy. It's not easy to actually break through those initial, like, we don't really know each other at the beginning. But I read something quite fascinating. I'm an introvert, so I'm guilty as charged. I greet people, I say, how are you? And then I run away. And then I was so shocked when I saw a YouTube video where someone was explaining about how to go deeper in relationship, and said it actually was, they'd done a study and they worked out that small talk evaporates somewhere around, I think it's 6 minutes into your time together. So you have to sit with someone and make your small talk, because it's just a social security, and then you have to stay there beyond that awkward moment of having not much more to say. And then eventually, after, for me, very painful, long, extra time, which could be 3 minutes, you'll find your way into talking about something more meaningful. And you begin to go deeper in your conversation. So that's why there are benches. So you can sit down and you can sit at a table and you can actually just be there. And eventually someone talks to you. And if they don't, eventually you must just go and talk to someone. The point of why do we do the things we do as a church? It's because we as a leadership are trying to build a kingdom culture, just the way that you read about the church in the New Testament. I love this. When to give you an idea of what happens when you're in a good relational context. Some people see the task. They say, Jesus wants us to do a job. But Jesus saw friendship and said, if you see the value of him, then you'll do the task. If you love me, you'll obey me. So this is the difference between building relationally and building organizationally or functionally. And an example is in Acts 4 verse 23. The disciples have been in prison, and it says this in Acts 4 verse 23. When they were released, they went to their friends and reported what the chief priests and elders had said to them. So when they were released, they didn't go to headquarters and write a report. You understand, these guys are on the appointment of Jesus. They're working in his kingdom. And when they were released from prison, they didn't write a report and send it back to head office. They went to their friends. So that's an important understanding of the early church. If it had been structured, they would have gone back to the head office. If the church had been structured in the sense of, like, bureaucratically, organizationally, they would have had a leader to report to. So they would have gone to report to that person. But it says when they were released, they went to their friends and reported. It's beautiful. So let me illustrate this a little more before I try and explain a bit about our church in the future. The goal of our faith is to know God. It's not to be holy. I'm not saying you shouldn't aim to be holy. I'm saying holiness is not the goal. Holiness is a means to a goal. The goal of our faith is to know God. It is not to be holy. To be holy is a means to be near to God and for him to be near to us. Because God isn't going to mix with something unholy. He's not going to draw near to you. When we make our focus on how holy we are, we become a little bit weird, a little strange. Some Christian movements have done that in history. You ought to study them. They can become very weird. Let's not pick too much on any particular one. But we must actually aim rather at fellowship with Christ. If you make fellowship with Christ, or knowing God and being intimate with him, your aim, then along the way you will become holy. Why? Because if you love me, you will obey me, Jesus said. He says, like, I realize I want to know God deeply. I want to enjoy God sweetly. Therefore, I'm going to repent of my sin. Do you understand? It's a relational way of looking at it, not a religious way. The religious way is, I want to make myself acceptable to God, so I'm going to clean up my act and then God must accept me. It's dead. It's like, I love God, therefore I will repent of my sin. I love God, therefore I will bring my life in order. This proves the only valid reason for resisting sin, the only lasting reason in the long term. And in fact, relationship underpinning everything we do as Christians. If you tithe, give God offerings, it's not protection money. You're not afraid of God that He will smite you and bring bad in your life, and so you tithe in order to be sure you don't get sick. Some churches have preached that in this city, that if you don't give, God will be unimpressed with you and bad luck will come in your life. They don't call it bad luck, but they're pretty much acting superstitiously towards God and preaching a kind of a prosperity where you give because of otherwise you fear of being on the wrong side of God. That's not the gospel at all. You give because it's your delight to give, because you love God and you love everything that He's doing. And so it becomes a cheerful act of worship, not a religious duty. And in our meeting together, it's revealed, for example, that some of us find a social less important than some other works-based moment. So let me give you an example. In a week's time, our music team's going to get together, and the music team is going to have some fun together. They're going to probably buy some pizza and hang out. I think so, am I right? I don't know, I think I saw that on the group. So if you didn't get that memo, and maybe you're not in the music group, you're excluded. They want to enjoy some time together, but someone thinks, well, I'm really busy that day. I'm going to skip it, and I won't be there, but I will be at the practice. I will be at the practice, but I'm sorry, I haven't really got time for the social. Do you know what you're really saying? You're saying that you think that friendship and relationship is less spiritual than functioning, than using your gift, than being, you know, on stage. There were times where we had small groups in a church, and then we announced that we were going to do a games evening for the small group. It's like a home group. And when you do a games evening, and then someone decides he's not going to come because that's not important. But if you're going to have a Bible study, then they're there like a bear. Because they want to have teaching. I must have teaching. Give me discipleship. No, what you need is relationship. And we have people with that same mindset coming into our church, and they say, where can I get on a thing like a DTS? Where can I get training? Where can I get training? Where can I learn more? And I'm like, I hardly even know you. You haven't even come to the church for a few months. Why not just settle down and learn to enjoy the company of other believers? Why not understand that we should have friendship before function? Because we need friendship after we function. We need relationship in heaven. So why not prioritize just being part of the church? So someone came into the church a few months ago, and their first question to me was, how do they get to sing in the choir? And it's like, I'm not mocking that person, but it's deeply disturbing to me that they're more interested in using their gift than knowing who we are. We want you more than we want your gift.
Yeah.
That's what it means to be part of a family. So some don't understand why we do tea and coffee in the BOMO, or why we have family days and picnics and soccer Sundays that we used to have, but we don't have so much anymore. It's because church is far more than worship and hearing sermons. It is lives intertwined with one another in the love of God and the commission of Christ. There's a friend that sticks closer than a brother, we're told in Proverbs. And that's why we should go beyond brother to become friends. Some of you thought brother was the highest thing, but actually friendship is perhaps even more of a privilege. Your brother is forced upon you. Friendship is something you opt in for, you choose. You choose your friends, you don't choose your brothers. And so in the church, it's easy for me to call you brother. It's harder for me to learn your name. And I want us to be a church where we learn one another's names. I'm very bad with names. It's not an excuse. Don't use my inadequacy to justify your failure to invest. I know that certain people call Christians brother as a kind of it's an easy way to deal with one another. I think it's okay at a conference. Call each other brother at a conference. But here in this community, we must learn one another's names. And you can call me Kim or Pastor Kim if you're so wired that it's your only way of recognizing that I'm a pastor or even your pastor. And I'm not trying to shun the responsibility of being pastor. But I'm altogether happy that Paul introduced himself as Paul. He said, I'm Paul, an apostle. And I'm altogether aware that throughout the New Testament, you don't find people using titles. You find them describing their role with something like, there's a pastor, there's a teacher, there's an evangelist. But we don't need to be apostle so-and-so, or bishop so-and-so, or pastor so-and-so. We need to have a deeper quality of relationship. Deeper, to the point that we really start to see each other. When you come to value friendship with God and with the saints, then you're forced to practice forgiveness.
Yeah.
It's not the functional forgiving because you're commanded to, but the relational forgiving because you want to have unity. So we were planted as a church with roots that go radically towards relationship, understanding these things. We had an expression, friendship before function, as one of our values. It's not tokenism. It's reflected in the biblical church. We put the person before the ministry. We're slow to promote and appoint because we hold the person as more valuable than their gifting. And we build this way further afield too. So as we've planted churches out from us, I got a call last week or just before, a friend of mine who was an elder in this church who now is leading another church in the city, and he just messaged me and he said, could you come and preach in my church soon before you go to South Africa on the 2nd of March? And I said to him, like, I can't do it. He asked me for the 2nd of March. I said, I can't do it on that day because I'm actually flying straight after the church meeting. So then I could tell from his tone, he just needs some encouragement. He just needs someone to come and join him in his battle. Just like the Philippians were missing Epaphroditus, this guy is my friend. And he said, please come. So I won't see you next week. I'm going to my friend. I'm going to hang out with him. So you are my primary circle. But because we build relationally, I'm going to go and share in a friend's church. I have to be sent. You have to release me. I'm not an apostle. I'm serving the church that way, but I want us all to see how important these relationships are. It's not structural. It's not like he looked at the calendar and said, let's bring in a guest speaker. There's a huge difference. We don't do guest speakers in this church. The people that I've invited into the pulpit are people that I've generally had in my home around my dinner table before they even stand in the pulpit here. Because that's how the New Testament church operated. It didn't just fill a slot with, a gift. But I feel like we've lost some ground as a church. Now in a kind of a serious moment, I think we've lost a little bit of our DNA. A lot of these things were reflected years ago. In Andronomena, we used to meet in another venue. It was still Vision Valley School. But we had access to that venue any night of the week. We used to do arts and music events. We used to do leaders training. We used to have a midweek prayer time. We used to have like a warmer atmosphere. And over the years, various things have made it harder for us as a church. The move to this venue came with a more industrial feel, no floor tiles. And I've enjoyed the fact that the church could be extremely comfortable with discomfort. What I mean is, you guys have been fantastic at not complaining that the chairs are getting broken, and not complaining that there's dust, or not complaining that, you know, we don't have cool decor. So while on the one hand I like the fact that we as a church are not living for comfort, I don't like the fact though that we as a church have been experiencing a shrinking relational sphere over time, in that the school has steadily over years put us under stricter and stricter limits. And in March 2024, we got a letter that basically said we can no longer use the school except on a Sunday. No weddings, no events, no midweek meetings, no, it's just Sunday. So this has made me slowly start to realize what I've compromised on. We weren't allowed to put up posters and things on the walls. We had to negotiate quite a lot hard to get that quilt put up there, because it was donated to us by a former member as a loving gift. So why I'm telling you this is, I still desperately want family day picnics where we as a church can just hang out for hours enjoying watching the kids play on a jumping castle. But we used to have access to the nursery, and now we don't have access to the nursery anymore. So we can't go and picnic on the nice piece of ground watching our kids close up on the jumping castle. We basically used to have opportunities to do men's breakfasts on Saturdays here. We no longer have those opportunities. I'm sharing all of these not as, it's not in my control. I'm not bitter about that. I'm absolutely grateful for the years we've had in the school. I'm absolutely convinced that our future is not in the school.
Yes.
We have come to the point where we've been extremely settled, as if it's a permanent venue, but it's never been a permanent venue. It's never been ours to customize or ours to use to our full extent of what a church community could do. And in fact, over the last couple of years, our opportunities or privileges to use the school have decreased and decreased, to the point that I can no longer carry that privately, but I have to share it with you. We as elders have discussed these things for months, for many, many months. It's not a new thing to us. But it may be a new thing to you that we as a church are actually losing ground in terms of all of these opportunities to have more relationship and have more fun together and have more training, DNA courses, new members courses, and investment into the life of the congregation. So I feel like the time has come to announce we're fighting for our future, but that fight is not against flesh and blood at all. It is not against the school. I love the school. It is a question of what is God's inheritance for us as a church, and what should we be praying for. And I want us to be praying for a better facility, possibly on a piece of land that we pay for and own and can really use to serve the kingdom's purposes. So that's the long-term desire, is that we would actually have a place that we could call our own and that we could really make it warm, inviting, and friendly to visitors, and put up pictures and, you know, something that reflects the warmth of our hearts. In the meantime, what do we look forward to? Well, as a church, some of you will come and go in a matter of weeks or years, but in the long term, we want to establish ourselves until Jesus comes back, that we can be a lampstand that keeps on burning. But it's not the venue that does that, it's the people that does that. For us, though, to feel like we're not settled permanently here, but willing to pay a price to obtain a piece of land or something, I'm perfectly willing for us as a church to go to a temporary venue in the interim. In other words, if that creates sufficient instability for us to feel that we're not permanently settled, then we may move to another venue that's not even our final venue. Why would we do that as a church? We would do that because in that context we would be negotiating the terms of our rent and what we get for our rent. In this context of the school, we've never had such an agreement. There is no negotiation, and our what we get for what we pay is just being shrunk and shrunk and shrunk. And so it's a sign from God that our future is beyond this venue. So while you might have loved the parking and loved the venue, please don't attach your heart to a venue. Attach your heart to God and His purposes and His people. And so when we go one day from here to some other venue, it's because God is leading us forward towards an inheritance. That inheritance is going to be built on values, and those values are going to be relational. And that's why I am still fighting this fight, that this church doesn't lose relational ground. I don't want us to have to go through inconvenience, but I'm not willing to sit here and die either. So in due course, we want to be able to have weddings in the church. We want to be able to have funerals in the church. We want to be able to put up artwork for the glory of God that reflects the heart of this church. We want to be able to shape things to represent this church better. But for all of that, it's going to require that we love one another deeply and that we journey through that together. So for those of you who are just visiting, I apologize for that last 10 minutes. It's more in-house stuff. But there has to be a time where, as a leadership, we can tell our congregation something of the prophetic future we see. We see God giving us something eventually where we can build a church that we can actually shape things around our values even more, that we would enjoy even more, that we would see the kingdom advance even more powerfully in people's lives. So the band, you can come up.